Iambic Audio presents The Land at the End of the Working Day. Four stories by Peter Crowther. Narrated by Robert Kuiper. Dedication. Dedicated with profound affection to Spider Robinson, Arthur C. Clarke, Fletcher Pratt, and L. Sprague de Camp, fine bartenders and tailspinners all, and of course to my constant companion, Nicky. Wine, beer, and cocktail enthusiast extraordinaire. Part 1. Gandalf Cohen and the Land at the End of the Working Day. Waiting for his drink, thinking about Tom Ankles Talese, an epithet of sorts earned over many years, as a result of the fact that Tom spent so much time so far up the chairman's ass that his ankles are usually the only parts of his anatomy visible. McCoy Brewer watches himself in the large mirror propped up behind the bottles on the back counter at the Land at the End of the Working Day, playing back the events of the past few hours. The Working Day is a two-flight walk-down bar on the corner of 23rd and 5th that not many people know about, even though it's been here for almost 8 years and is just a block away from the Dowager of 23rd Street, the Chelsea Hotel. It's there that the tourists go with their Nikons and their Pentaxes, capturing each other's vacuous smiling face on cheap film, a strangely talismanic process that somehow imbues their empty lives with a little art and maybe just a little history, to take the shaky and badly cropped results home to bore their friends at the end of interminable dinner parties, for which the level, not to mention the sheer invention, of last-minute cancellations never ceases to surprise them. Strange illnesses and bizarre accidents, such as obscure relatives from equally obscure out-of-state towns who have cut off their feet with a lawnmower. In the early hours of a clear morning, spring or fall, summer or winter, when Jack Fadogan's booze has been flowing, and the conversation has been just right, you can walk up the Working Day's steps and out onto the waiting street, and you can maybe hear Dylan Thomas eternally whispering to Caitlin that he's happier here than anywhere else, and her telling him she feels that way too, their voices drifting on the Manhattan breeze the way only voices can drift, moving away for a while and then moving back, saying the same things over and over like cassette ribbons, proving that no sound ever dies, but only waits to be heard again. So, too, do the voices of James Farrell, who really was the hero of his own book, Studs Lonigan, and Don't Let Anyone Tell You Different, and Arthur B. Davies, Robert Flaherty, O. Henry, John Sloan, Thomas Wolfe, and Edgar Lee Masters, all of whose names are recorded forever on a plaque fixed to the red brick wall of the Chelsea, the ancient echoes of their soft words wafting up the 10 stories past 10 little cast-iron balconies, there to drift around the gabled roof and maybe roost a while, watching the sun come up across the East River and the distant smoky towers of fabled Brooklyn. There are other voices, of course, and if you strain real hard, maybe you'll even pick up Martha Fishburne, a native of Des Moines, telling her husband Gary he drinks too much as he stumbles up onto the sidewalk of many months past. Or Nick Hassam, a British would-be writer of American detective fiction, telling both the street and his wife of 1 week, Nicky, that he's having the greatest honeymoon anyone could ever have, that this is the most magnificent city and she the most wonderful wife. The people who come to the Land at the End of the Working Day are no strangers to the voices that ride the currents around 23rd Street, just as they're no strangers to the voices inside Jack Fadogan's fabled bar. Most nights, the ambience in the Working Day is just about right, not too many people so that it's crowded, but enough so's you don't feel like a single coin shuffling in a lint-lined pocket, bereft of old friends and realizing you're the next one to go. But no matter how many people, there's always laughter in the air and talk and company. Tonight is different somehow. It's different because the place is just about empty, and it's different because the night itself is different, hesitant and expectant, its cosmically existential heart as alive to the myriad possibilities that confront it as a light bulb is to the eternal promise of a daily dose of electric current. McCoy Brewer watches the reflected world through the big mirror, accepts his dry martini, and nods to Jack Fadogan, who grunts obligingly and then shuffles along the bar, trailing his towel down the polished surface, while McCoy takes a slug of almost pure gin. Almost pure because Jack Fadogan's dry martini means he simply immerses a glass pipette into the vermouth, waits until most of the liquor has evaporated or dripped off onto the waiting tissue, and then briefly submerges the now little more than scented implement into the waiting highball glass of iced gin. Strong, but good. It's a little after 6 p.m., and McCoy feels the winter in his bones. The drink helps some, but only some. Managing to dispel the memory of the darkness of the early evening streets, but failing to touch the greater ebony gloom in McCoy Brewer's soul. He feels it course down his throat, and he slides sideways onto a bar stool, already thinking of the next martini, and the one after that one. While he thinks, he watches the people in the mirror world behind the bar. Over in back, in one of the booths, a woman sits against the wall, a lady lifted straight from the musty, dog-eared pages of a Jim Thompson paperback original, her nylon stocking right leg propped up along the length of the mock plastic cushioned seat, the high-heeled shoe hanging from her foot and swinging to and fro in the narrow aisle that gives on to the ornately carved 3-foot-high balustrades separating the booths from the tables. She's sipping a cocktail, her fourth since 5 o'clock, and she looks as though she's nowhere near finished yet. Almost as though she can feel him watching her, the woman glances up and looks across the tables into the big mirror, sees McCoy looking at her through the glass, sees his eyes, and smiles briefly. McCoy nods, lifts his own drink and raises it in salute, watching his own reflection and that of the woman lift their own glasses in response, and in the silent camaraderie of drinkers, two characters in a lost Edward Hopper painting, swimming the dark seas of nighttime and solitude. The woman's name is Rosemary Fenwick, a fact which McCoy will learn later, and she is drinking Manhattans to the memory of a husband and son she left behind in Wells on the New England Atlantic coast almost a year ago. Seeing their faces in her mind's eye superimposed on the face of the man in the barroom mirror, never having heard from them in all that time, silently wondering now, this night, what they're doing. Only one of the tables has people sitting at it. It's a quiet night in the working day, unusually quiet. But maybe it has something to do with the mood of the streets outside. Sometimes the streets have a frenetic quality, a nervousness that splashes up unseen from the pavement and the sidewalks and seeps into the people of Manhattan like radiation, giving birth to uncertainty and a need to consolidate and regroup, maybe around a cocktail or two, or a couple pitchers of beer. The streets disguise this activity under a cloak of subterfuge, worries about money, about health, about work, and about the faithfulness of partners. But it's the city, and deep down most people recognize this, though only a few acknowledge it. For nothing that ever happens in the city happens without both its knowledge and its approval. At the table, midway between Rosemary Fenwick and McCoy Brewer, two men sit hunched around a pitcher of beer. They're exchanging stories, telling jokes, telling them in the slurred tone that comes with the temporary abandonment only liquor can give, laughing as they recount and sometimes even before they hear the punchline. Jim Leafman works by day in the city's refuse department, collecting garbage, sometimes picking up broken and discarded memories thrown out along with the ends of greening cheese and bacon rinds. His wife, Clarice, is having an affair with a salesman who sells office furniture, wood veneered desks with pull-out work surfaces, and who lives one block away from their 23rd Street apartment. She thinks Jim doesn't know about it, but Jim knows. He smelled the cologne that isn't his, and he's imagined the hands that aren't his traveling around his wife's body. Imagine Clarice whispering, "No, no," but really meaning, "Yes, oh, yes." Something Clarice hasn't said to her husband in a long time. A time that Jim has measured only in gained pounds, thinning hair, and punishing credit card bills. Jim has parked outside the man's apartment building, sitting out on the street in a 74 Oldsmobile that's 2 parts yellow and 8 parts rust, its muffler held in place with hope and duct tape, watching the doorway, nursing his old 38 in his lap like it was a baby, waiting for the traveling salesman to show. Jim has seen this guy, seen him a couple times now, watched him strolling along the sidewalk like he didn't have a care in the world, strolling along in his Gucci loafers and his soft-woven plaid jacket, pants with front creases that could cut meat, immaculate hair swept back and held in place like Cary Grant, or an underworld hoodlum out of a Scorsese movie. Then, on these occasions, Jim has glanced in the rear view, seen his own jowly face and pasty complexion, and he's decided that a guy doesn't deserve to die simply because he looks good, any more than a guy deserves to die simply because he looks like a small-town department store window mannequin, its plastic skin worn and dented by the years and the constant magnified sunlight. After some thought on one of these occasions, Jim has also decided a woman doesn't deserve to die simply because she wants to do better. But these decisions have taken their toll, and Jim Leafman is now in need of a joke. So too is Edgar Nornhaven, one time big, but now slimmed off some, slimmed off a little too much some. Like the guy in the Stephen King book who just keeps on losing weight and can't do anything about it, no matter how much chow he puts away. Edgar Nornhaven, bearded and full of bluster, even though it feels like he's passing broken glass when he pees, a thin trickle that falls from his penis in drops instead of powering against the back of the stall, the way he hears other men pee when he's standing there, concentrating on his flow, the way his doctor has told him. The same doctor has told Edgar it's a problem with the prostate, and he's having Edgar take pills that seem to help a little. But Edgar has also had some tests, one of which involved the doctor running a tiny seeing eye down his penis and then staring, one eye closed, into the end as he twisted the thing around inside Edgar. Lying there with his dick feeling like it was on fire, feeling like he needed to pee worse than ever before in his whole life, all 53 years of it, Edgar watched the doctor, saw him frown, twisting the tiny seeing eye back and forth in his belly, heard him let out a tiny groan, an oh dear groan, like the doctor was seeing something that he didn't want to see, something that didn't ought to be there in Edgar Nornhaven's stomach, something maybe like the thing that burst from John Hurt's guts in that Alien movie a few years back. The doctor told Edgar as he was pulling his pants on, Edgar, not the doctor, still feeling like his dick was on fire, that he was going to send off a swab for analysis, but that certainly, that's the word he used, certainly, the prostate seems unusually large. The results came back 2 days ago, since which time Edgar has been hitting the juice. Drinking for two is how he tells Jim Leafman. So, yes, Edgar needs to laugh right now.
"Hey, Mac," Jim Leafman shouts across to McCoy Brewer. "You too good to sit with us these days?"
Jim has just been told a joke about a guy with a bad flatulence problem, which ends with the line, "You're wrong about the smell," and he's still laughing. Jim laughs a little louder and harder than he needs to, mainly because he's covering up the fact that until a few minutes ago, he didn't know flatulence was just a $2 word for farting. McCoy turns around and beams a big smile, raises his glass and moves away from the bar, moves a little reluctantly, reluctant because he doesn't really want to talk to anyone right now. He doesn't want to talk to anyone because he's just lost his job. This very day, his job with the Midtown and Western Trust and Loan, the only company in the city with two ampersands in its name. Right now, staring in the big mirror, McCoy Brewer doesn't care squat about ampersands. He just wants to come to terms with corporate speak, words like downsizing and outsourcing, words he doesn't know whether they're hyphenated or not. As he walks across, McCoy hears Jim Leafman keeping the fart joke rolling with a few one-liners, schoolyard rhymes like,
"He who smelled it, dealt it,"
to which Edgar Nornhaven says, pointing his finger in mock accusation,
"Hey, you do the crime, you do the time."
McCoy pulls up his chair, says, "Hey." Jim waves him and carries on chuckling, shaking his head as he pours another glass of beer from the pitcher.
"Hey, listen up now," Edgar says, leaning across the table, resting a hand on McCoy's arm by way of greeting. "You ever wondered why a man's dick is shaped the way it is?"
He looks at Jim, sees he's not about to get anything reasonable by way of a reply, and turns to McCoy.
"Mac?"
"Uh-uh," McCoy says truthfully.
"I mean," Edgar goes on, looking around to see if anyone is listening, "you know,"
he draws the shape of a penis in the air in front of him, accentuating the large end of the shaft,
"why it's wider at the end than it is on the shaft?"
"Uh-uh," McCoy says again, just as truthfully. This time Jim Leafman shakes his head too, getting into the yarn.
"Well," Edgar confides, twirling his fingers around the rim of his glass, "it's something that's been bothering folks in the medical profession for a number of years."
He pronounces it profession, slurring the first syllable and pulling it out so it comes out kind of like a belch, waving his left arm with a flourish.
"Particularly the French, the British, and the Poles."
"Yeah?"
The way Jim says that, he could almost be believing it, and just for a moment, both Edgar and McCoy consider telling him, "Hey, Jim, it's a story, right? It ain't real." But neither of them does. Instead, Edgar goes on,
"Yeah," he says, "see, the French, they conducted their own research. Took them 8 months and a couple million francs, and at the end of it all, they come up with this. The reason a dick is shaped the way it is to give maximum pleasure when the guy is dipping his biscuit in the gravy, you know what I mean?"
Edgar pushes his finger in and out of the hole made by the thumb and forefinger of his other hand. McCoy smiles and leans forward on the table, reaching for the pretzel dish, and lifts a couple to his mouth, crunching them.
"Okay," says Edgar. "So the British, they've been wondering about the same thing, and they conduct their own research. They are not convinced by the French, no siree. You know what I mean?"
McCoy and Jim decide they do know, and they nod.
"Hey," Edgar says, "like a common market, you know what I mean?"
He laughs and watches them both nod and smile before continuing.
"So," says Edgar, "they spend, £500,000, something like that, and after another 6 months, they agree that is to improve, you know."
"Dipping the biscuit,"
Jim ventures.
"Yeah," says Edgar,
repeating the stunt with a finger going in and out of the hand hole.
"Only this time, they decide that it's for the woman's pleasure. That's why, you know, why the dick is shaped that way, is so it gives a little flick on a vulva as it goes in and out. You know what I mean?"
McCoy frowns. "The vulva?"
"Yeah. Is it the vulva?"
Edgar says, suddenly unsure. Jim Leafman shrugs, looks first to one of the men and then the other. McCoy says, "Vagina. I think it's called a vagina." Now Edgar shrugs.
"Vulva, vagina, who the hell cares?"
"Right,"
agrees Jim, taking a hit of beer.
"Yeah, right,"
echoes Edgar, the debate over anatomical correctness clearly having put him off his stride. And he also now feels like he needs to pee.
"What are you?" he asks McCoy Brewer. "Some kind of optometrist?"
"Uh-uh," says McCoy. "I'm a mortgage clerk, you know that. Only I lost my job today, so now I'm nothing."
"You lost your job?"
says Jim, his face slack and concerned. As McCoy starts to respond, Edgar bangs the table with his right hand.
"Hey, we telling stories here or what?"
"Sorry," says McCoy.
"Sorry,"
says Jim Leafman.
"Can you believe this guy?"
Edgar asks McCoy, nodding in Jim's direction.
"Just tell a story already."
"Okay," So where was I? See, I can't even remember where the fuck...
The British,
Jim says softly.
They decided it was for the woman's pleasure.
He looks like he's about to do the trick with the fingers in the handhole, but instead he reaches for his glass.
Yeah, right,
Edgar says, and he chuckles. So, the Poles. Now he gives a real snort.
They decide they want to do their own research, because, you know, they don't agree with either of the other two. So they start their own survey study, you know, and they spend a couple of days and a few who,
He pauses and looks across to the bar.
Sees Jack Fadogan polishing a glass while he watches them.
Jack! Edgar shouts across. Poles, where they spend?
Jack Fadogan squints and shifts his weight from one foot to the other.
What do they spend?
For a second he wonders if Edgar is having him on, asking him something so he can make him look dumb. He rubs one calloused hand across his chin and with the other carefully sets the glass down on the bar counter.
Yeah, what do they use for money?
Jack shrugs, says, they use the same as everybody else does. Leastways they do in my bar.
Edgar waves his arm.
No, he says, in Poland, for Christ's sake. What do they use when they're at home in Poland?
Pesetas, Jack suggests.
McCoy snickers.
Is it drachma?
Jim ventures, looking first at McCoy, then at Edgar.
I think I heard something about drachma. I thought maybe it was Rubik's, but that was a guy that made the cube. Did you have one of those?
Jim Leafman says to McCoy. McCoy nods. When they first came out, I bought one.
Me too, says Jim. Almost did it one time, two squares out.
Okay,
Edgar says impatiently.
We'll go for drachma. So they do this research, right? Takes about 2 days and costs around 50 drachma.
He shrugs and raises his eyebrows. In other words, not very much, you know what I'm saying there?
Anyway, they come up with the answer.
He leans forward and lowers his voice a little.
The Poles. They figure a guy's dick is shaped the way it is so your hand doesn't fly off and hit you in the face.
He slaps the table in tune with the word face and leans.